Okay, wonderful. Well, it's been a long day. There's been a lot of interesting talks, and I promise to allow you to eat and see a movie and everything. So, of course, it's always spectacular to be at the KITP. Let me get rid of this. And I thank the organizers for the invitation. So I want to talk about, first, a couple of things which I'll just do on the blackboard momentarily. I just want to say a little bit about some of the talks that we heard about already, which have some, I think, interesting, some conceptually interesting new things about them. But what I wanted to do with the slides was mostly talk about a few topics which haven't been explored so much in this community, but which I think are really interesting and are starting to open up, and many more interesting things might happen in the future. So it's really more, there'll be a few results. It'll be mostly an invitation to think about some of these other things. A number of you are thinking about them already, but I think it'll be, there'll be a chance that many more interesting things will come out of it. And I just want to say a few words about the sort of philosophy that's not only going to guide this talk, but that many of us have been following for a number of years and thinking about scattering amplitudes, which is sort of what the goal of all these investigations are. One goal is, of course, to compute scattering amplitudes because you want to for a whole variety of reasons, either because you think it's cool or because experimentalists need them or whatever. That's perfect. That's a perfectly good goal. There's a kind of a sort of philosophically opposite goal, though, which is of course very much goes along with trying to compute them in order to get data, in order to answer this question, which is not to compute the amplitudes, but to not to find an answer, but to find a question. We want to know what is the question to which scattering amplitudes are the answer. Okay, and of course there's one obvious question: they're the answer. Scattering amplitude. Okay, so what I mean is that if you imagine you're some experimentalist at infinity, and a crossing symmetric infinity world where all particles are incoming, you're an experimentalist at infinity. You just measure these things. Some things go in, some things go out. Things light up here and there. You have no idea what happened. There was some sort of black box happened. Things went in. Things came out. And from that pattern of massive data, you can ask, what is it that happened in there? Okay. And the conventional answer for what happened in there is that the particles moved into the space-time, and they banged into each other. And they did this, and they did that, and we summed over all the possible ways that could happen, and they came back out, and it was quantum mechanical, unitary, local evolution in space-time from past infinity to future infinity, and that is the answer to this question. And had we not seen all the stupendously magical structures in the final answers experimentally by people who needed to get the answers for a whole variety of reasons, mostly to connect with experiment, we might have been satisfied with that. There's no other question to which the amplitudes are the answer. But we've been seeing over the years other questions to which the amplitude is the answer, other things that could go in that black box in the middle that don't look like local unitary evolution through space-time. For example, the black box on the inside could be the correlation functions of a bunch of vertex operators on a sphere. We're just talking about tree amplitudes, okay? And that's a completely different, that's a completely different looking black box that, and I should have said, there's a property of the amplitudes. However you fill in the inside of the box, there's this property that these experimentalists with these measurements would notice. They would measure, for example, in the tree approximation, that these amplitudes have singularities in prescribed places and that they factorize on those poles. So that's an invariant fact about the amplitudes that this evolution in space-time picture is making very obvious, okay? And in fact, you would even notice that and say, ah, that's why it's evolving in space-time, because that sort of guarantees that all those singularities are where they're supposed to be. Well, experimentalists measure these things in all possible places, and analytically you can see them if necessary. And they just discover this experimental fact about these functions. Whoa, they blow up here, right? And then when they fill in the inside in that way, they say, oh, I know why they fill in there. They hit each other, they propagate over a long distance, and they turn into something else over there. And yet we know there's this completely different picture of an auxiliary world sheet theory, and with a completely different reason, more abstract reason that we just talked about, that the boundary of that moduli space factorizes, and that turns into this statement that we otherwise normally ascribe to particle propagation in spacetime. Now, we first encountered this in string theory, and it's an incredible thing then, and it's an incredible thing now, all right? And we encountered it with alpha prime that even helped us cure perturbative ultraviolet divergences and so on. And we also discovered that this is not so far away from the Feynman diagram picture after all, that there's a limit in which we can see it as being a thickened version of the picture that we talked about before. And as you all know, and we've seen many beautiful talks at this meeting, that there is another avatar of the same underlying mathematical structure that works even directly at alpha prime equals zero and is sort of capturing the same singularity structure, the same structure of the boundary of the moduli space is giving us the singularities in the final answer in another very beautiful way. Now, something else that we've seen in the past number of years is yet another gadget that can go inside. Now, this is even a little bit more abstract compared to the things that we saw before. Now, there are positive geometries that they live in very auxiliary spaces. And these functions are the answer to a canonical form that has prescribed singularities on the boundaries of this object. And the logic of this positive geometry tells you that things factorize, but in a way that's less easy to see directly how it's related to the space-time picture. It gives you other things, though. For example, it gives a sort of more seamless connection between trees and loops. And a more obvious way of making some of the hidden symmetries and special theories manifest. And I think most fundamentally of all, it has fundamentally a combinatorial origin, kind of not really a geometric one. Even though we keep talking about geometries, everything you actually do with these things is basically combinatorial. And as you saw in Hugh's talk today, and I will say a little bit more, what really defines these things are sort of keeping track of patterns of plus and minus signs. There's something very, very primitive seeming about it, which through the logic of positivity and the rest is doing exactly the same thing. It's another thing that can go in these, another thing that can go inside. So, and there may be many others, but part of the purpose of asking this backwards question is if we can find more questions to which the amplitudes are the answer, and hopefully we see the relations between them. There's just a proliferation of zillions of them. Perhaps it'll start giving us a sense or a picture for some more primitive origin of the locality and the unitarity that's being reflected sharply in the singularity structure of these objects and is being made manifest in the evolution through space-time picture. So that's one large motivation, and I'll say a little bit about it on the blackboard in a second, a little bit more. We've heard a lot today already. Another basic philosophy, and this isn't so much scientific, it's purely a belief. It is purely a belief. It's my own belief about this subject, completely subjective. But I think this is a cartoon of what a hard-nosed person looking from far away at what's been going on in this subject might say has been happening. Yeah, there's all sorts of cool things going on. That's great. You guys are having a lot of fun. It's wonderful. But you're having a lot of fun with toy models, right? All sorts of things, integrability, n equals a, all sorts of stuff with toy models. And there's the real world down here. And I think a sense, and it's not an unreasonable sense that a lot of people have, is, oh, you're getting lucky. You know, things happen nicely up there. There's more luck as you go towards toy models and less magic as you go from the toy models to the real world. That's a perfectly reasonable attitude. I don't believe it myself. If I believed it, I wouldn't be working on this subject. I think it's not luck. It's not luck that we're seeing all these structures. It's not luck because I think there is something there. There is something there which is a generally new, different way of thinking about what this physics really is. Could be wrong, it could be luck, those guys could be right. But if this is true, then there's another prediction that as you get closer to the real world, you should see more magic, not less, okay? And of course, that might seem completely insane, right? That we should see more magic as we get closer to reality. But I remind even the enthusiasts of this business to remember what it would have sounded like to someone 20 years ago if you told them about the kind of structures that we've seen, given what they knew about NMHV tree amplitudes in the year 1995. It would sound completely insane that there is the kind of stunning simplicity and structures that we've seen. And I also want to remind you something about these toy models in our business. These toy models in our business are not super duper duper far from the real world. In some approximation, they are the real world. Okay, as we all know, leading order approximation, all this geometric stuff, CHY, ample dihedra, all this stuff, it's happening. Every time two protons collide, it energies 1,000 times the proton mass. So the couplings are weak. This physics is actually happening. The dominant physics, there are three amplitudes, and it's actually happening in the real world. So anyway, so this is a pure belief, and so those two things are going to guide what I want to tell you about in this talk. And please don't get terrified at this outline. But there is four things I wanted to talk about. I suspect I'll have to skip topic two, hopefully we can talk about it in another visit or with people who are interested later today. I want to first say a few things, picking up from Song's talk, about what's emerging. Something I think is very interesting is the beginning of a unification of what seemed like very, very different geometric pictures for what was going on. We had world sheets, we have Grassmannians, ample dihedra, and there's a set of ideas that he referred to that start bringing them together. I want to tell you the evidence we have that indeed there is an avatar of the ample dihedron in momentum twister space that is essentially via twister string theory, okay, or is related to the RSV formula. And I want to tell you some pictures for why it's true and the one piece of quite miraculous evidence that it's probably true. I think a lot of this work has been done in the context of integrands. It's really too bad that Mark Spilin or Nastya Volovich couldn't make it here, because there's been a lot of beautiful work they've been doing that is starting to very directly tie the nature of the final answer, the loop integrals, to positive geometry. And again, in the spirit of getting closer to the real world, we should start being able to understand simple facts about the final loop integrals and the amplitudes in more algebraic geometric ways. This part is sort of based on ongoing work with LSUN, but I won't have time, probably won't have time to talk about it. And then I will talk about two directions which haven't been explored very much, as promised, very little relation to the other things that we've heard about. Actually, this has some relation to things that we've heard about. There's a general question of how, given scattering amplitudes, you could reconstruct the interior of the space-time and really see that it came from a local theory. A very backwards question. I want to ask the question, how, if someone handed you the scattering amplitudes, would you discover that they came from Feynman diagrams? I want to rediscover local fields, Lagrangians, Feynman diagrams. How is all of that stuff sitting there in the scattering amplitudes? Because after all, when we say that locality is reflected in the poles of the amplitude, that's a very highfalutin way of talking. Locality is that, right? that you have to reach out and touch someone in order to make something happen in the middle of the space-time. And how do we see that from the amplitudes? Okay, so that's a subject. That's the first subject I'll talk about with slides. And then in the spirit of getting closer to the real world, I want to start telling you the rules for how we do S-matrix theory for any mass and spin. Okay, and in particular, everything you teach in an introductory graduate quantum field theory course, including the standard model, G minus 2, the beta function, anomalies, the Higgs mechanism, how can you do all of it purely from Poincaré invariance and unitarity, never touching a Lagrangian? And I'll show you some examples of how it works. So that's our plan for the next 20 minutes. All right, so can we get rid of the... So the first thing I'm going to do is just a few things on the blackboard about the first topic. Oh, okay, sorry, just do this. Nope. You don't know? Oh, do not raise all the way. But I have to sit here, otherwise it'll raise all the way. So, okay. All right. Can we get rid of the light? Okay, this will be brief. But I want to sort of summarize some of the things that we heard in both Hugh and Song's talk from an elementary perspective. So let's say we're interested in amplitudes and a planar theory. We found the good momentum twister variables. We have all sorts of reasons why we like momentum twisters. Penrose might have liked these things, right? You've gone to the boundary, you have the right variables, everything is great. The data that labels a problem is a bunch of momentum twisters, okay? And you found the right boundary variables, etc. Now, this was sort of Penrose's big accomplishment, was to find, in this subject to begin, which was to find the right variables with which to describe things. Great, we've done it. Now, what is the dynamical rule that out of this data produces an answer that you can call a scattering amplitude? And that's where they got stuck, right in the beginning, right? What are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to write down a Lagrangian on twister space? Why would you do that? There's no locality fundamentally on twister space, okay? The Lagrangian in space-time makes sense. Why would you write down a Lagrangian in twister space? Now, there are twister aficionados here that'll yell at me and say there are Lagrangians in twister space, but they're not local Lagrangians on twister space. And I think if you had never heard of scattering amplitudes, you would probably would not have written down these log det objects as the first thing you would think of. Maybe they will correct me, but anyway, so what are you supposed to do? And what the substance of what we heard in Hugh's talk and in Song's talk can be summarized in the following way. That what you're supposed to think of, what scattering amplitudes are differential forms just on the space of the kinematical data. Okay, so there's a differential form omega, and this space is four-dimensional. And if we're doing n equals 4 super Young Mills, there's a 4k form on this space. And of course, if you expand it out, it would have different components, d squared z1, dz3, dz4, times something, plus dot, 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 dot. And the idea is that all of these pieces are the components of the superamplitude. In fact, this is the superamplitude. If you replace the dz's by eta's, which are anti-commuting as well, then this is how you go from a superamplitude back to a form. And at first it seems completely cosmetic, except you can do something with a form that you can't do with an amplitude. You can integrate it. Okay? You can look for what its residues are. You can integrate on cycles. You can discover the fact that it's written as a bunch of d logs. All of these things are not possible when you write it in terms of the eta's, but become manifest when you write them in terms of the forms. Fine. So first of all, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for some 4k form. This is just a tree level. We're looking for a 4K form on the space of kinematical data. But what should fix that 4K form? And that's where the second part of the story comes in, is that in this configuration space of Z's, there is a part that has, there's an interesting way the Z's can look. Okay, there's an interesting way these Z's can look. For example, we can demand that all the II plus 1, JJ plus 1s are positive. That's putting in the physics of never hitting the local poles. And as Hugh explained, that isn't enough to fix what we're talking about. But we can furthermore demand that the Z's have a certain winding number. Okay, they have a certain shape. That for some configuration of Z's, that collection of simplices, II plus 1, JJ plus 1, winds around the origin some number of times. And there are other ways of describing it that he alluded to. Let me tell you the fastest way of characterizing it, which is to just take this configuration of points and ask what it looks like when you look in the direction of some number of the Z's. If you project through three of them, and I don't have time to explain why you can choose these three canonically, but just choose any three in a row, like 1, 2, 3, so if I project through 1, 2, 3, this four-dimensional picture drops down to a one-dimensional picture. And in that one-dimensional picture, all you have to do is look at the remaining points and just demand that they flip over the origin k times. Okay, so that means that this sequence, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 1, 2, 3, n, has k sign flips. So it has some number of sign flips, and you just filter what it looks like by having k sign flips. So this is some geometric subset. It's characterized by these topological, these very simple topological properties. Here it's even more primitive. Anyway, you're just jumping back and forth around the origin k times. Now, that's it. Now the claim is that the 4K form, what determines the 4K form is that it should have logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of that space. Okay? So in other words, the 4K form, the only places it should have singularities are where you're threatening to violate these winding conditions. Okay? These topological and winding conditions. Now, what could that mean? Because a 4K form is a low-dimensional form, it's not space-filling, right? But this is a space-filling condition. Well, what you have to do is pull back the form to a canonical 4K-dimensional space in the configuration space of all the kinematic data. And there's a very simple 4K-dimensional space. It's just a 4K-dimensional affine space where you start with some particular set of Zs and you just translate them in the direction of a general K-plane in the n-dimensional space in which they all live. So there's essentially unique linear space inside the configuration space of points in four dimensions in momentum twister space. I'm just saying all of this to emphasize that I have not once said the word y, the extra components. This is all something that's defined purely on the kinematical space of external data. I've given you now a 4K dimensional space, which is just a linear translate of the data in the direction of a fixed K-plane. And if you pull back this form onto that 4K dimensional space, then it should have logarithmic singularities on when these topological conditions are violated. Okay? So, and the claim is that fixes the form. Now, I don't have time to explain it, but that whole process is essentially the avatar, the image of the ample tetrahedron directly in the configuration space of points. But it means that in this seemingly completely barren world of just a bunch of points in P3, there's room for the origin of dynamics is topology and ultimately combinatorics. Okay? Once you have the idea that you're looking for, the object you're looking for is supposed to be a differential form on this space. That is a general idea, and that's what Song was referring to. We can think of amplitudes as, in very general theories as differential forms on the configuration space of data. And so what we're invited to do, you see, now there's no eta's, there's no supersymmetry, right? Everything is bosonic. And so at least we can attempt to let our imaginations go wild and see what might happen if there are other things around. For example, maybe there's a line at infinity that breaks conformal invariance here. What am I supposed to do with that line? How's that line supposed to be wound around by this data? Okay? So maybe there are further geometries that we could talk about. And maybe there are further ways of prescribing singularities, the analog of forcing logarithmic singularities on these geometries. And perhaps those fill out forms of all possible dimensionalities, not just these 4K dimensional forms. And perhaps we can interpret those as the forms associated with less supersymmetric theories. This last 30 seconds is pure fantasy. But we can now think about it. We can think about it because the language is divorced from supersymmetry now. Okay? We can imagine that on the configuration space of points, there is topological properties that determine nice subspaces, and that we're looking for a way of attaching differential forms to those subspaces that convert them into physics. Now, a little test case for this philosophy is if we can understand what the ample tetrahedron defined in this way, it looks like in momentum space. And let me just spend just a tiny bit of time explaining what that could look like. So before getting there, there's a small amusing detour, which is that anyone who's played with amplitudes in momentum twister space knows that parity is something difficult to see in any of the Wilson loop pictures of scattering amplitudes, right? Parity in the original momentum space exchanges k with n minus k, but in the momentum twister space, because we're stripping off the Park Taylor factor, parity is not obvious, and it's interchanging k with n minus k minus 4. That extra minus 4 is really weird. Where does it come from? Why is there an n minus k minus 4? And no existing approach to the Wilson loop in twister space, momentum twister space, no approach makes parity obvious. The only way to prove parity that I know of is you start with some representation, you convert it to the Grassmannian representation, and then the Grassmannian tells you how to go from momentum twister space to twister space. However, this combinatorial description makes parity trivial. Okay, so you have this thing, you have this sequence. So let me first tell you how you see the n minus k minus 4 popping out. You have this sequence of minors, and the length of the sequence is nicely n minus 4. And now there's a very trivial thing that you can do. There's a very simple, obvious, there's a very simple, obvious little group transformation, which does something very, very simple. Take every z, take every other z, and flip its sign. Okay, if you take every other z and flip its sign, everywhere before there were no sign flips between two consecutive guys, there will be a sign flip and vice versa. So if you do this completely trivial operation, there's a totally trivial flip every other z, z2, so I'll call it z2 trivial. Z2 trivial takes you from k sign flips to n minus k minus n minus 4 minus k sign flips. And that's the magic n minus 4 minus k that we have for parity. But this is an utterly trivial, this is an utterly trivial z2. There's a non-trivial z2, which is that something else momentum twister aficionados know, that we can think about points in momentum twister space, zi, but we can also think about planes in momentum twister space made out of three consecutive zi. And physically, parity interchanges these two guys. Okay, so parity interchanges the z's and the w's. And now there's a non-trivial fact, but which we can prove. There's a non-trivial fact that if the sequence 1, 2, 3, 4 up to 1, 2, 3, n has k sign flips, then the sequence 1 bar, 2 bar, 3 bar, 4 bar, in other words, the obvious parity conjugate of the points will also be in the amplitudehedron with the same k. Okay, so these are two interesting facts. That's a statement of parity in the amplitudehedron at tree level. The statement at loop level is simply that now at loop level I also have some lines in this P3. So being in the amplitudehedron means that if I further project through those lines, then the resulting data again doesn't have k sign flips, but has k plus 2 sign flips. So Hugh didn't have a chance to talk about this, but this is our definition of the loop amplitudehedron, and then the statement of parity, which I don't have time to explain, is that this has k sign flips. Okay, so this is an interesting offset by 2 in the number of sign flips for AB and for the z data and its parity conjugate data. So I emphasize all this because it's a very natural question to ask purely about the amplitudehedron. But now we're going to use it in order to have a very natural guess for what the image of all of these sign flip winding patterns are in momentum space. So what I now want to do is tell you, we just said in momentum twister space, I have a bunch of z's and they have some winding, and that's what it means to be in the amplitudehedron. Now I want to ask, what do the lambdas and lambda tildes look like? What do the lambdas and lambda tildes look like in momentum space when the z's are correctly winding in momentum twister space? Okay? And if we have a picture for what that subset of ordinary lambda-lambda tilde space is, then we can conjecture that the tree amplitude is the differential form with logarithmic singularities on the boundary of that space. All right? So let's see what it looks like. Well, there's only one thing that obstructs us in going from momentum space, momentum twister space, momentum space. We have to choose infinity, okay? Because we have to define lambdas and lambda tildes that breaks conformal invariance. So we have to choose infinity. And here is where we have to guess something. Where should we put infinity? So we have these z data. Where should we put infinity? Well, we put it in a random place, and probably nothing good will happen. So the conjecture is we should put infinity in the amplitudehedron. Okay? If we put infinity in the amplitudehedron, then this gives us a prediction for what the sign flip patterns of the lambdas and the lambda tildes are. The reason is simply that now call AB infinity. Okay? And the z data projected through infinity is otherwise known as the lambdas. And the w data projected through infinity is otherwise known as the lambda tildes. Okay? So that's why I went through all of this, because the statement of parity at loop level for the amplitudinhedron translates to the following statement, that the lambdas should have winding number, or flip number, let's call it flip, should have k flips. So this literally means you look at like 1, 2, 1, 3, up to 1n. Okay, you have a configuration of lambdas and lambda tildes that conserve momentum, and this sequence should have k sine flips, and the lambda tildes should have k plus 2 sine flips. That's what we get from the amplitudinhedron. That's what we get if we put infinity in the amplitudinhedron, but that's a parity that's breaking parity. So we should either put infinity in the amplitudinhedron, or we should put infinity in the parity conjugate of the amplitudinhedron. And if we put it in the parity conjugate of the amplitudinhedron, then we see that this thing, just by following the logic, this takes us from k to n minus k minus 4, so this thing should have n minus k minus 2 flips, and this should have n minus k minus 4. Okay, so it's one or the other. And that corresponds to the choice of putting infinity in the amplitudinhedron or in the parity conjugate of the amplitudinhedron. All right, so that's it. This is our picture for what is the subspace, now completely an ordinary bosonic lambda-lambda tilde space, which corresponds to the amplitudinhedron, now making a guess that what we should do is put infinity in the amplitudinhedron or its parity conjugate. And now we say there's a 2n minus 4 form with logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of that space, and that's the superamplitude, okay, in the sense that Song described in his talk. Okay, now there's a little amusement, because remember, in order to specify what I mean by it having logarithmic singularities, you have to identify some canonical, in the previous story, to identify a canonical 4K-dimensional subspace in the space of external kinematical data, to pull the form back there and decide that that's where it has logarithmic singularities. What is the analog of that here? Here, it's a 2n minus 4 form. Now, the external data is naively 4n-dimensional. Of course, there's momentum conservation, so it's really 4n minus 4-dimensional. And there's the little group, so it's really 3n minus 4-dimensional. 3n minus 4 is larger than 2n minus 4. So I have to make a decision for how to go from a 3n minus 4 to a 2n minus 4-dimensional subspace. And there's only one natural choice. Go to the celestial sphere. All right, so it's just clear, right? You just take the data and you choose a frame, and in that frame you freeze the top component, and then you just look at the dependence on everything else. So that is our claim. The claim is that when you freeze to the celestial sphere, there is configurations of the lambdas and lambda tildes wind around either that many times or that many times, and there is a unique form of logarithmic singularities in that space, which is called the scattering amplitude. Okay? Now, what is our evidence for this? Well, apart from these numbers are a little bit funny. If you only know about momentum space, these fours, these are sort of funny things. The fact that they come out immediately from these things that we're familiar with from the amplitudinhedron is one. If you're very naive, and when we were first talking about it with the song, I told them, well, clearly it should be k and n minus k or something like that, and that's clearly wrong. Okay. And that's good, because that's not what the amplitudinhedron tells you. But here is the evidence. And this allows me to amplify something Song said in his talk. So I think we've gotten accustomed to the idea that there's a difference between some intrinsic property of the amplitude or the form and representations or formulas for it. Okay? So an intrinsic property of the form, no matter how you get the answer, is that it has singularities in certain places and it factorizes, for example. Okay? But you can have representations for it in concrete ways, Grassmannians, CHY, and so on. Okay? Now we're saying that we're replacing all of the standard business about the physics of poles and factorization and so on by these topological requirements. Of course, we already have an existing formula, the CHY equivalent to the RSV twister string in this case. And what that formula must be doing, if this picture is right, is the following. This is this basic push-forward philosophy that we've talked about already a couple times. Let me say it. A little schematically. The idea is you have some simple space that you understand, and you have a form with logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of this simple space that you understand. But then there's an interesting map that, and importantly, what this map needs to do is one-to-one map all the real points on the interior of this space into some complicated space. Okay? But it has to be one-to-one. Okay, every point in here, the pre-image of so every real point in here should come from a specific real point in there. Okay, so if you have a map like that, then the claim that we talked about and gave many examples of to the in the paper that was alluded to by Song that we wrote with Yontel Bai and Thomas Lam, is that the push forward of the map, the trivial map in this space, which would just be, for example, a bunch of d logs of the positive variables in a simplex, push forward under this map gives you the complicated form of logarithmic singularities on the boundary of the new space, but not for a random map, if and only if it has the property that every point is mapped one-to-one to a point inside. So you need to find a single real positive solution. As Song emphasized, there are complicated polynomial equations. We sum tons of solutions. We're not saying that all the solutions are real, definitely not. But in order for it to be a map from one space to another, there had better be a single real positive solution from this space into that space. Okay. And so the evidence and the little miracle that I alluded to in the beginning of this discussion, that what we're talking about is on the right track, is the following. Take the RSV equations and ask, when do the RSV, choose lambda lambda tilde randomly, you'll get complex solutions, strange solutions, lots of solutions. Ask, when is it true that those complicated RSV equations have the property there is a single real solution? A single real solution where the sigmas are ordered as they're supposed to be ordered on the world sheet. And the answer, experimentally, with no theoretical proof that it's true, but the answer experimentally, is that there is a single real solution if and only if the windings for the lambdas and lambda tildes are precisely these ones. Okay? So that is some evidence that the RSV is actually doing what Song said it should do, that it's a push-forward formula, but what it's doing is building the form of logarithmic singularities on this space that's characterized in a invariant sort of combinatorial way. And of course, hopefully, if we understand it here as we're trying to understand it in the context of the amplitudehedron, perhaps we'll find other ways of figuring out what it is. All right. So that was what I wanted to say about that. And when did I start? How long do I have precisely, Zvi?
10 minutes.
Oh, really? That's interesting. All right, fine. I'll even skip. I'll go straight to to something more concrete. I'll go straight to this topic, and I think this will be fun for this audience. But really back to real life. Oh, thank you. All right. So this is in the spirit of the second part, that we should hope that we find more magic when we get closer to the real world. And step one is to figure out how to talk about the real world in the nicest. Oh, I shouldn't take this off. In the simplest, best possible way. I mean, in the easiest possible way. So this part of the talk is mostly some very responsible, be a good Boy Scout, put your hat on, do things right kind of thing. And there's a little bit of magic here and there that I will allude to. But I'm really, really enjoying this collaboration with Yutin and a former undergraduate of his, I guess, very talented undergraduate who's now a grad student at Caltech. All right, so we're going to talk about getting closer to the real world. Every time, I don't know, those of you who give colloquy on scattering amplitudes, always some 12-year-old kid or a 80-year-old professor in the audience who will say, what about massive particles? You know, isn't it all special for a thing? And so you always say, yeah, probably not, but let's just do it, okay? All right, so we're gonna talk about how to describe scattering amplitudes for any mass and spin, and in particular, as I said, we'll sort of cover, at least conceptually, the entire content of a first year graduate course in quantum field theory in the next 15 minutes. All right, so what is the drama of, what's the kinematical drama of scattering amplitudes? The kinematical drama of scattering amplitudes is that they're not Lorentz tensors. Okay, that if you do a Lorentz transformation, they have to pick up the action of the little group. And so you have to build objects that transform in that way. When you transform with a momentum, you pick up, for massless particles, you pick up the action of the rephasing. Now, that's the purpose in life of spinner helicity variables in four dimensions. It isn't just that they're a cool way of representing the momenta. It's not just a trick. The spinner helicity variables are the objects that transform like bifundamentals under the Lorentz group. Namely, when you do a Lorentz transformation that leaves the momentum invariant, it doesn't leave the lambdas invariant. They pick up the action of the little group on it. So the amplitudes are not functions of momenta. They are, as we know, redundantly functions of polarization vectors in momenta, which is why most people who take quantum field theory courses never see an actual scattering amplitude. But they are functions of spinner helicity variables. Okay, that's what they are in four dimensions. And we know that, so this is just the kinematic property. If I rescale lambda and lambda tilde, I'm supposed to pick up the correct phase. So that's how the helicity is encoded. And these are things that are all totally familiar to this audience, so I'll go through it quickly, but just to establish some of the logic of what we're going to do. We're just going to be talking about three and four particle amplitudes in the rest of the talk. But I remind you that massless particle dynamics, as also Jake reviewed, are essentially fixed by Poincaré and unitarity. When you have massless particles, the lambdas are parallel, the lambda tildes are parallel, and so the three particle amplitudes up to an overall constant are completely fixed by the helicity information. That's it. But that's not true at four particles. We have STU. We can have, in principle, arbitrarily complicated functions, but we are making the assumption that we have an underlying weakly coupled theory, which is translated to the statement the amplitude has very simple singularities. It can only have poles, and then the physics of unitarity, causality, locality, all of these things in one spot is the statement of where the poles are, only when STU goes to zero, and that on the poles, the amplitude should factorize into the product of the three particle amplitudes, which we've already fixed by symmetries. So, for simple theories, like scalar theories or Yukawa theories, there's no problem in building objects like this. You simply go to the S-channel residue, you glue the three particle amplitudes together, you get the residue, you multiply by 1 over S, and you sum over the channels. And that gives you something that's guaranteed to have the correct factorization properties. And maybe you're missing some contact pieces. So that's the most general ansatz you can have for a four particle amplitude. But things are interesting when you have massless particles with spin, starting at spin 1 and higher, because of the famous fact that the three particle amplitude for these guys is already non-local. Okay, so this is a funny thing. It's not true for phi cubed, where it's just a constant. It's not true for a Yukawa, where it's just angle bracket 1, 2, local. Right? Already, the Yang-Mills and graviton amplitudes have things in their denominator. That's weird. Why is there something in the denominator of the three particle amplitude? It's already not quite local. We console ourselves because in Minkowski space, there's zero. Right? But that's the origin of the difficulty with massless theories, theories of massless particles of spin. Already the three particle amplitudes aren't local, and that shows up because it obstructs this stupid strategy for building objects that factorize properly. If you glue two things together, what do you discover? You discover that the residue, when you glue them in the S channel, it has a pole in T if you have a spin one particle. Okay, and it's even T squared if you have a spin two particle. Right? So naively, you're screwed. You say, oh gosh, so now if I multiply by 1 over s, now I had better just pray that the residue works in the t-channel. And it does. For spin 1, it does. And so not only do we conclude that the theory is correct, that we conclude that it factorizes probably, we also compute the amplitude. Now what about gravity? There's a t squared. Uh-oh, that looks bad because there's a double pole. But you say, no, remember, that's when s goes to 0. So that could have been a t times negative u. Right? And so you say, okay, let's relax and put down a 1 over STU, and you check all the other factorizations, and it works, and that's the gravity amplitude, but let's go to spin 3. No can do, right? There's a T cubed, and nothing you can do can convert that to a single pole, and that's why massless higher spin particles are illegal. Okay? Interacting. Now, already there's this famous tension between locality and unitarity that we see for particles of spin 1 and 2, exactly because of this product structure downstairs. Okay, it is impossible to expand those things as a sum over over different channels, S, T, and U, without breaking Lorentz invariants. Yes, sir? Yeah, I just mean a simple, I mean, it's just semantics, but if you take a phi cubed, I mean, let's not call it phi cubed. If I take a three-particle amplitude for scalars, it's just a constant, so I can just call it mu. Okay? If I take a three-particle amplitude for, let's say, two negative helicity fermions in a scalar, it's just 1, 2. So it's a polynomial in the lambdas. Okay? But if I look at the three, let me do it here so you can see. If I look at the three-particle amplitude for gluons, it's 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3. What the heck are these things doing in the denominator? Okay? The three-particle amplitude has poles in it. Yes, there's a delta function for momentum conservation, but which indeed. So sorry, the delta function for momentum conservation only tells you that the lambda tildes are parallel, and there's some constraint on the lambdas, but it doesn't stop you from taking this limit and making the three-particle amplitude blow up. Now that's a little funny because normally when amplitudes blow up, you think it should be factoring into something, but there's nothing for it to be factoring into here. The reason it doesn't bother us, the reason we don't talk about it in courses, is that this thing vanishes in Minkowski space, right? But conceptually, it's there, and you know, it's a very big part of the Grassmannian story, huge part of the Grassmannian story, that you have to care about all of these stupid little singularities that go all the way down that you normally never think about, but they're a critical part of the whole Grassmannian geometry. In fact, it's really absolutely crucial to the story that it's all there. But I want to say that's the origin of why there's something new about massless spin 1 and 2. You see it already in the three-particle amplitude. It's not quite local. Okay, and we'll see this echoed when we talk about massive particles in a moment. But I'm just quickly reviewing some things that most of you know. All right. Now, if we keep going, these arguments tell you why it's impossible to have massless higher spin particles. If you have gravity or if you have Yang-Mills theory, if you have, we discover from these arguments that gravity and Yang-Mills have to be universal, but if you try to couple, let's say, a photon to a massless higher spin charged particle, then you discover that the residue in the S channel has a pole in U, and the pole is too high a power, and it's impossible for this to factorize properly if the spin is greater than or equal to 3/2, okay? So from these arguments, we discover the only consistent four particle amplitudes are for theories of spin 0, 1/2, 1, 3, 1/2, and 2. We discover supersymmetry, we discover the gravity is unique. All the theories that we know and love are just the answer to the simple algebraic question of building consistently factorizing four-particle amplitudes. All right, so this is lore in this subject. There's been some nice papers on it in the past couple of years, but every practitioner amplitudologist knows these things by heart. Now, I'm just reviewing them because we're going to see how it changes when things are massive. Now, but just to summarize, obviously there's no Lagrangian, there's no quantum fields anywhere here. Analyticity, saying that you have only poles, is encoding somehow the physics, the imprint of causality. So we're putting that in by hand. Once we say that, things like CPT and the existence of antiparticles are essentially hardwired. Okay, so I'm just going through the standard things we prove in quantum field theory from local Lagrangians, how we say all those things from this point of view. So those things are hardwired in, but for example, you discover spin statistics. Spin statistics is a consequence. Spin statistics is a consequence of the fact that if you try to couple any particle to gravity, because of this business that the poles in one channel fix what the residues in all the other channels are, you don't have the freedom to choose how you add the different channels together with signs to get any statistics you want. The statistics is forced on you and it's the correct one. Okay, so spin statistics is a consequence. The Weinberg-Witten theorem and the Coleman-Mandula theorem are elementary consequences of the fact that you can't have massless higher spin particles, okay? Or multiple massless interacting spin 2 particles, for example. All of these things come out of the argument. For example, what is Weinberg-Witten? It says if you had some underlying theory, it cannot produce, with a local stress tensor, it cannot produce a massless spin 2 particles of bound state. Why? From this point of view, if it could, weakly couple it to gravity. Then you have a theory of two interacting massless spin 2 particles that these arguments have just ruled out. Okay, so I'm just going through this just to say everything that we, that the sort of famous things that we talk about in field theory are an elementary consequence of these things already at the level of massless particles. Now let's move on to massive ones since V told me I have 5 minutes left 5 minutes ago. So all we do is we continue, and we just keep going. Now the momentum is massive, not massless. So that means that P doesn't have rank 1, it has rank 2. So let's just write it as a sum of 2 lambda lambda tildes. Now people have done this in many ways before, but we're just emphasizing that you can do it in a way that makes life maximally simple. So I can write it this way. I'm just choosing to put the index upstairs and contract with the epsilon ij in order to manifest an SU2 index on this thing. Really, it's SL2. There's an SU2 index, and that is the little group. Okay. Once again, if you do a Lorentz transformation on P that sends L to P to P, it will send lambda to an SU2 rotation on lambda. Okay, so that I is just the little group index. The determinant of lambda times the determinant of lambda tilde is m squared. This is the Dirac equation, but we'll never see gamma matrices ever in this formalism. Okay, this just tells you that if you want, you can convert lambda to lambda tildes using momenta. And so the final little thing is that instead of labeling the external states the way we do in undergraduate quantum mechanics, where we say that a state is specified by giving its spin and the spin in some z direction, we do it in an even dumber way, which is tailored to SU2. We just represent it as a symmetric 2s rank tensor. That's a nicer way of labeling states because it doesn't break rotational invariance just by the labeling of the states. Okay, so that's it. So amplitudes now, just like with spinner helicity, now they're functions of lambda I, lambda tilde I when you have a massive particle, and instead of having weight h or 2h in the lambdas, they just have to have that many of the little group index. All right, now let me give you a tiny example of what amplitudes look like. So, and just a little toy calculation before we get more systematic. So let's take as a simple example a fermion coupled to a scalar. So how do I write down a three-particle amplitude? Well, it has to have an I and a J index. So there is one thing, and I can contract them like this, or I can contract the lambda tildes like that. Now, notice this is an expression that would make you a little bit scared if you're a massless person, because I'm adding angle and square brackets together. That's fine, because I do not have helicity weights here. It's just SU2. This is an important fact in a second, because this is how massless amplitudes emerge from massive ones in a moment. Okay, but this is a perfectly legal three-particle amplitude. Now, you might think it's annoying to carry all these indices. If I have a spin 10 particle, I have to carry 20 indices around with you everywhere you go. But there's no reason to write them down, because you know what you're going to do with them. You're going to fully symmetrize them. So just don't write the indices down. Okay? So this is a slightly better notation. I'll just underline the particles that are massive with a bar to remind myself that they are massive. But there's no reason to carry the index around. Okay, so this is what the three-particle amplitude looks like. And then this is one of the simple cases where I can glue two things together and get a four-particle amplitude. Okay, so how do I glue them? When I glue, just the little group index on one side and the other turns into an epsilon, and I just contract them. There is nothing to do. Okay? So this is the amplitude then. This is like a scalar Compton scattering amplitude. And I want you to notice there's no gamma matrices. There's no Dirac equation. There's no U bars and Vs. All of those things are an artifact of the underlying field picture, because you imagine there are fields and you're putting them on shell. Even when we use polarization vectors for spin 1, it's because there's fields and we say epsilon mu with epsilon dot p equals 0. We imagine it's a field and we're putting it on shell. Here there's no fields. We're just directly talking about the particles. All right, so I hope you agree that looks nicer than formulas you've probably seen with slashes and u bars and v's. And you can directly turn it into angles. I mean, it is just directly a function of the angles. Now, here's the fun thing. How do you take the massless limit? Let's say you want to go to the high energy limit. Just erase the bars, and you're done. Okay? When you erase the bars, now you have something that looks illegal, right? The sum of the different pieces. Oh, those are the different helicity components. Okay? So when you erase the bars, that is the minus minus helicity component. That's the minus plus helicity component, and that is the plus plus helicity component. Okay? All right. So it's possible now to go through the whole story again of writing down the most general three-particle amplitudes. Sometimes they're unique. Sometimes there's many structures, and we can go through them systematically. Zvi is going to kill me if I do. But for example, if I do two massless and one massive particle, there's just one structure, and things like Yang's theorem are completely trivial. Okay? Not only do you discover that a massive spin one particle can't decay to two massless spin one particles, but also something I didn't know, that a massive spin three particle can't decay to two gravitons. Okay? So it's exactly the same statement. The really interesting thing happens when you have the ubiquitous situation of two particles of equal mass and one massless particle. And here there's something we call the X factor, and I don't have time to explain it, unfortunately, but it's exactly the same as the massless particle. And this is the drama. When you have a massless particle with spin, now even if it couples to massive other particles, the difficulty is that there's not an explicitly local expression for the three-particle amplitude. You're trying to write down a basis of relevant objects that have the relevant spinner indices. Precisely when the two particles are massless, there's a degeneracy and you don't find a basis, but this vector P1 lambda tilde is proportional to lambda. The constant of proportionality is a piece of data. It carries little group weight, but you cannot write down an explicitly local formula for it. And so, for example, here are familiar things. Like, here is the amplitude for a scalar coupled to a photon. It's electric charge mx. That's the X factor that I talked about. For a graviton, exactly the same thing with an X squared. What about for a spin a half particle? There's a piece with the electric charge. Now I have a new structure that I can write down here. That can have a lambda alpha, lambda beta, and that also has a name. It's the G minus 2. Okay? And so on. Okay? Okay, so you can then go through the whole process, figuring out what minimal coupling means, gluing things together, and in this case, now we don't find any restriction. It's possible to make consistent amplitudes for any particle. Okay? That had better be, because there are massive spin 17 particles around in nature, and you and I have huge spin, and we consistently scatter off gravitons. So we better be able to do it consistently. But of course, something interesting has got to happen. And so let me give you an example. Okay? Here is an example of what the formulas look like. This is what Compton scattering looks like in this formalism. Okay? Compton scattering, again, like typical for gauge gravity amplitudes, there's two poles. It cannot be written as a sum over two channels, exactly for the same reason that we talked about before. But this is what it is if it's a spin zero particle, if it's a spin a half particle, and a spin one particle. Okay, no gammas, no polarization vectors, and you see that spin one is spin a half squared, the sort of thing that will be very difficult to see in the conventional language. Again, you want the high energy limit, you drop the bars, and that's it. But what's wrong with massive higher spin particles? You discover they can't be point-like, because these consistently factoring amplitude, unlike the lower spin cases, have the property that you cannot take the mass to zero. Okay? Something had better obstruct it, because we know that the massless limit doesn't make sense, and what obstructs it is the second you go above the mass of the particle, these amplitudes blow up like hell. And so there's no consistent theory of isolated particles of high enough spin, and this is, I think, the clearest reason for it. Okay, of course, we know this. They're either Kaluza-Klein modes, string modes, and every example, they come along with other things. But this is, a very simple, there are many other ways of seeing these things, but this is a unified picture for the kinds of things that look like elementary particles we see in the world around us. Okay, there's a reason why the elementary particles have the spins that have the spectrum of spins that they do. So I really didn't have time to describe it in detail, and I really will end Zvi before you kill me, but it is possible to do everything you normally cover in an intro QFD course, including computation of the G minus 2, QCD beta function anomalies, and the Higgs mechanism in this way. And what I like about it is that it's an absolutely direct route from the direct principles, put in Poincaré invariance and unitarity, and just you see what the consequences are, I think, in a very clean and nice way. And I'm not going to go through this in any detail, but in this audience, you'll just see what the pictures are, and you'll know the computations I'm doing. This is just things from our paper. This is the entire computation of the electron G minus 2. Really, swear to God, nothing is left out, and the electron G minus 2 comes out in two lines. Okay? And it comes out because if you've ever computed the G minus 2 or looked at it in standard textbooks, the big hell is extracting what's G minus 2 out of the big horrible expression. Here it's just built in. You know what's G minus 2. It's that piece, the lambda lambda piece of the three-point function. So what are we doing? We're just gluing computing the leading singularity, figuring out the coefficient of the triangle is, and this is the entire computation. And we can do the same thing for the QCD beta function. We can ask, we can probe the QCD beta function very physically by asking about, imagining we have a massive spin one particle and asking about the dependence of some, you know, some probe scattering of the vacuum polarization on the mass. We're doing the computation in this way in order to avoid various infrared subtleties that in fact doing these calculations just straight in QCD, but it's exactly the same content. That's why it helps to have the massive formalism. So this is the external probe that we're talking about. These are the things that are coupling to some photon. We're going to be talking about charged particles of various spins, spin zero, spin a half, spin one. Okay, you just compute the tree amplitudes by gluing things together, and then you compute the corresponding unitarity cut, and this is the entire computation with the 11/3 at the bottom and everything. All right, and finally, I'll leave as a trivial exercise for this audience is to discover the Higgs mechanism from this point of view. What is the Higgs mechanism? We can do it from the bottom up, but we can also do it from the top down. The top down is very analogous to how we do things with Lagrangians. So the idea is the following. You start with a bunch of consistent massless theory in the ultraviolet, a bunch of helicities. Okay? The first step is you do nothing. Okay? All I do is I take those helicities and I regroup them. I say, you guys, that helicity, come over here. I'm going to write you, I'm not allowed to put pluses with everything because they're different helicities, but temporarily I'm just going to bring you over here and put a plus sign. I'm grouping you together. I haven't done anything. Okay? I'm just moving the massless amplitudes around. Second step, add masses to the propagators. Done. Okay? Now you have to do a little check. You have to check that it factorizes correctly. Now on the new massive poles. And if you just do it, sometimes you will not get the right answer because, of course, there could be subleading pieces in the in masses that are not quite right. But it's a completely systematic procedure to go and put them in. This is how you discover, for example, that there has to be a new cubic Higgs self-interaction in the Higgs phase, right, when the Higgs gets a BEV. So that's how you discover that from this point of view. It's a completely trivial exercise. You start, well, maybe not completely trivial, but for this audience, it should be a very simple exercise. But conceptually, the point is you start with massless amplitudes. You first rearrange them so that kinematically all the eating has happened. Now you put bars on everything and you check factorization. All right, so that's it. I should say that I think the time is ripe more formally to, now that I think the simple way of thinking about all these things is clear, is to think about computing all the amplitudes in planar n equals 4 super Young mills on the Coulomb branch, and that's something that we're starting to do with UTIN as well as with Rutger Bolt. All right, so there's a 10-second thing. If you know how to calculate massive amplitudes, then you are secretly also computing correlation functions and Wilson loops. Okay? All the physics, for example, let's say you want to compute the correlation functions of a stress tensor. That's the same as imagining you had a massive spin 2 particle that you ultra-weakly couple to the sector that you're interested in, and you're calculating the scattering amplitudes of that massive spin 2 particle. After all, that's how experimentalists measure correlation functions, by coupling to massive detectors on the outside and seeing the response of the detectors to the system. Okay? So if you want to have a very high spin correlator, you have to put a very high spin particle there. But now everything is on, at least all local observables in a field theory are on the same footing as amplitude. So anyway, I'll end with this picture. Again, as I said, I strongly believe that it's true, that the things we've been seeing in toy models are not luck, and that we'll hopefully start seeing more and more magic as we start approaching the real world. There's a huge amount of both work and fun ahead of us, at least for those of us who believe something like this might be true. So thank you. Not bad, G.
Yeah, you did.
Not bad.
It's okay. So I can tell you what I learned from your talk, Nima. I learned it's time to rewrite the textbooks. That's okay.
Well, UTIN wrote one already, so.
Yeah, write another one. UTIN, write another one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll just give the comment of the last minute. Local observables are equivalent to massive external state weakly coupled.
Yes, absolutely.
For any mass.
Yes. Yes.
So you have to, it's a little misleading to say that, well, that's a...
No, you have to do it for any mass. That's right. So we need to, yes. No, so in fact, if you...
It's not like on shallow. If I know it for all on shallow, the infinite number of on shallow.
Well, no. So let's say you want to know the stress tensor correlators, then you need to know the formula for scattering amplitudes for these massive spin 2 particles also as a function of their mass. Okay. Absolutely. Yes.
Otherwise known as local observable.
Yeah, I'm not saying anything that you or many other people didn't know 40 years ago. But I'm just saying that just as a practical matter, if you want to start computing correlation functions, this is a way of setting up what a correlation function calculation is, which is exactly the same as every other computation that people do when they compute scattering amplitudes. The only thing that's missing in this picture are like, yeah.
Scattering amplitudes give you everything, even offshore.
Right.
If you know scattering amplitudes for any mass.
Absolutely, and spin. Any mass and spin. If you know amplitudes for any mass and spin, well, but that's what we're just starting to figure out how to do. So that's the point. No, I'm not. You're absolutely right. I mean, that wasn't meant to be a deep new comment. I was just reminding people that if you open up the S matrix books from the 60s, they were scared of spin. They didn't like spin. They're horrible, complicated, terrible things about spin, and they didn't know. That's why a lot of it was about, as you know better than me, was about pions and maybe rho mesons or omegas every now and then. But if you really want to do correlation functions, if you really want to do any correlation function, you have to know how to compute amplitudes for massive spin 10 particles. At least the reviews I read were kind of scary, filled with lots of complicated orthogonal polynomials that I didn't know anything about. And part of the point is that in four dimensions, life is so simple because the good Lord gave us a world where the little groups are as trivial as possible. For massless particles, it's U1. And for massive particles is SU2, the two simplest groups in the world. And so we should take advantage of the utter simplicity of the representation theory for those two groups to make our life as simple as possible. That's all I was doing in that part of the talk. So that's the responsible part. The little bit of magic has to do with the X and the non-locality and all the rest of it. So, and if you paid attention to a Jake's talk, all of the business with that non-locality was strongly related to the Grassmannian representation. The Grassmannian representation was making those facts more obvious. So something that we're thinking about a lot is whether the structure of these three particle amplitudes already, when they're massive, is captured by an extension of the Grassmannian representation. There's certainly a need for it because the same kind of difficult constraints are present in the massive case as the massless one. So if there's room for the beginning of some magic, it would start emerging there.
Maybe yes. One more question. We're not gonna, actually, further discussion probably requires some alcohol. So. Thank you.